our last speaker when he is done. But our next speaker is Ken Turyan. He was our devotional speaker on Friday morning. He's a former president of ASA, and he has a longtime association with the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Ken. He's going to talk about science and faith issues in Islam. Is there an avenue of rapprochement between ASAers and practicing Muslim scientists? So, Ken, I need to give you the... Yes. Yes, this is for the recording. This isn't broadcasting because it's a...
Yeah, I hope not. Otherwise, the jihadists will find out.
Yeah.
That'll be the end of my talk. Yeah.
So I am going to go take people to the airport so you all have a good morning. I may be taking some of you at 1 o'clock or at 3 o'clock. So see you later.
Thank you. I'm pleased with the attendance. You know, my talk is left field. Kind of unusual to talk about Islam in an ASA meeting, but I'll show you as we go along about why it is important to take this thing seriously. This is my outline. First, facts about the Islamic world. Arrested scientific development. I'm going to show you some statistics where very little scientific output's coming from Muslim countries, starting to change. A little bit on Islam 101 for those of you who know what the fundamentals are. And then a quick look at the golden age of Islam, because this has happened in history. And the desire is to bring this situation back in this century also. A few notes on science and the Quran, efforts on concordance, Islam and Darwinian evolution, because this is a very serious debate right now. The most important is the points to ponder. Is there things we can do where we can find some common language with more than 1 billion people, the second largest religion in the world, which is also called the fastest growing? Okay, facts about Islamic world. 57 countries make up the Islamic conference. That's large. Most countries, and I'm going to show you data on this, most countries are disengaged from science and reasons for it. So they've given 2 Nobel laureates so far. That's the most they have given. One is Abdus Salam from Pakistan, and then Zuwail from Egypt. So that's the total sum of Nobel laureates, again, which reflects on the disengaged from science. The reason when you present this to the Muslims, they say, why is this so? Well, they say because the West and the U.S. uses inconsistent policies with these 57 countries or some fraction thereof. In other words, we support the Saudi Arabians as our wonderful friends, where this whole Wahhabi extremism comes out, you know, and then we attack Iran or criticize other countries. You know, there's an inconsistent policy, so they're not sure what we really stand for. In other words, we're pragmatic in our approach, and hence that somehow reflects on what they're able or unable to do. There's a victimization tendency among Muslims. This is one of the reasons, you know, because West has dominated or shown an inconsistent policies. So the result is that they feel marginalized. The Muslims feel marginalized generically and even in the scientific community. And then growing sense of victimhood as becomes the result. So these are the facts we face. And one of the reasons the jihad movement has started, one of the reasons, is this victimization that we face, that they face. So the result is, we, as we look at things, we have one of three things. Either we are afraid of Islam, or we're angry, fury, or we get fascinated with what is this religion that's spreading so fast and has, you know, become the second largest religion in the world. Well, some recent statistics, this was published in Physics Today, just to show you the disparity between Muslim countries and India, China, and USA. Look at the number of physics papers, for example. There's a big jump after Turkey and look at the numbers that have been published in this last few years. I think it gives in early 2007. Most scientifically productive Islamic countries as of early. These are the most scientifically productive out of the 57. So you see the disparity that's happening. Some more statistics. Total manufacturing exports from 22 Arab countries is less than the Philippines by itself or Israel by itself. Another disparity. Between 1980 and 2000, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Kuwait, and so on, all these collectively had 367 U.S. patents. In the same period, South Korea had 16,000, Israel has 7,000 patents. You see the feeling of victimhood developing here as they compare themselves to what other countries, developing countries, are doing. Books per year translated into Arabic in 22 Arab countries is one-fifth the number that's done by Greece, or by Greece translated into Greek. Again, falling back in scholarly activities. So keep that in mind. Let's have a quick look at Islam 101. Muhammad, of course, is the messenger of Allah. All prophets, such as Jesus, came for their own people, but Muhammad came for all people. Obviously, they have not read John 3:16. Muhammad is the example to follow in his, and it's given in various, his life, his actions, and his sayings are all written down. The religious book is the Quran. It is the written word of Allah, and Quran was revealed by angel Gabriel. Bible is also God's word, but it has been corrupted. This is one of the most difficult things to deal with Muslims when you want them to read the Bible, because they say it's corrupted, so I can't trust it. And it's unreliable. And the Quran really has replaced the Bible. And one important point to keep in mind, because we're going to make some comparisons here, it's every word was given by Allah, and so you can't even translate the Arabic. It loses its spiritual power. You have to memorize and recite in Arabic. I have a close friend from Afghanistan. He's a medical doctor. And he and I sat down and we started reciting from the Quran in Arabic. And he recited, I recited, he recited. I said, do you understand what it's saying? He says, I don't understand one single word. I say, why do you recite? He says, it's Allah's word. Just reciting it is enough to help my spiritual well-being. This is very serious. I mean, it's extremely important to keep in mind when you go into fundamental Islam or pure Islam. There is another one which is called the Hadith. This is the sayings of Muhammad. It is like the Apocrypha or the pseudo-Apocrypha. It is not fully spiritual, quote-unquote, but it's important because the jihadist movement is based more on the Hadith than on the Quran. The Islamic system, now this is key, because the Islamic system is a whole society. It's religion, culture, and politics. It is not just religion. And we'll come to this when we talk about the Darwinian approach to the evolutionary issues that they face. All right, their beliefs, they believe in Allah, they believe in angels, they believe in all the prophets. One of the starting points with Muslims is to talk about Jesus because it is highly honored. Jesus is the only sinless prophet born of Virgin Mary. Right there's an interesting thing. And he's the only one who did miracles. Muhammad didn't do it. So it's an interesting starting point. They accept the Torah. They call it Taurat. The Injil is the New Testament. The Psalms and the Quran. So these are some of the starting points of, especially in the theological discussion, to touch upon these and see if we have some commonalities, and we do. They have judgment, the last day, but it is based on fatalism. Man has no choice in any matter. Allah, although they're monotheistic, God is really is sovereign, but he's more of a dictatorial than in a relationship. There's no relationship. This is why they see Allahu Akbar. That's God is great. God is great. That's the most they can say. Of the 99 names of God, not one of them is love. Not one of them is righteousness. But one of them is justice. So those are difficult issues when you start dealing with, is their God the same as our God? Okay, and very quickly, what is jihad? They call it striving. But really, Islam is divided into realm of peace and the realm of war, pure Islam. In other words, if you're a Muslim, it's peace. If you're not a Muslim, it's war. Again, a very serious difference if you take Islam literally and as the Quran and the Hadith would say. So let's keep all that in mind. Now let's go to what really the meat of the talk is the golden age of Islam. There has been a golden age, and let me just quote here. It's an Islamic golden age, usually dated from the middle of the 8th century to the 13th century. All right, it contributed enormously to the arts, to literature, to philosophy, to science, and technology. All right, and Muslims are very proud of this, but there's a lot of controversy as to really what was the, how much did pure Islam really cause the golden age? That's very important because we're coming now to a point where we're going to open these discussions with them. Ex-Muslims claim rationalism of free thinkers at advanced medicine, math, astronomy, and philosophy, not reliance on the Quran. Okay, that's a very important distinction ex-Muslims claim. And then here are some examples of the famous people, Abu Bakr, Ibn Sina, Omar Khayyam, and so on. And all of them were non-practicing Muslims. Not only that, it looks like, let's look at the person who started this. The Golden Age was really due to the Abbasid dynasty of Al-Ma'mun. In other words, these caliphs were patrons of knowledge and scholarship. And so what they did is they established a house of wisdom in Baghdad and collected all type of scholars to come and translate from Greek to Arabic important literature. And the translators were not just Muslims. They were Jews, they were Christians, they were Hindus. And if you talk to a fundamentalist Muslim, he denies this. He says, no, we did the whole thing. But historically, we know that this golden age was because of the cooperation of Jews, Christians, and Muslims. This is why I'm raising this issue now. Can we do something similar, you know, in that context? For example, Abdus Salam, you know, who was a Nobel laureate that shared with Weinberg and Grasho, the electroweak and electromagnetic, the unity of those two systems, and won the Nobel Prize, I think it was 79. He's dead now. He was considered an infidel until he got the Nobel Prize. You know, then he became very famous because that was the first Muslim to get a Nobel Prize, because his position was there is no such thing as Islamic science, Christian science, Hindu science. Science is science. And you have your religious beliefs, you either harmonize them or you keep them apart. Because of that, he became an infidel. So today, the Islamic scholars critique Western secularism and the ethos of technology. That's where the main the battle is, really. Because remember, Islam is both cultural, social, religious, all put together. When they look at our secular approach, our ethos of technology, you know, and our movement away from spirituality, the criticism becomes pretty severe. Which then says, hey, that's great, you know, ASA is not in this category, therefore we may be able to deal with the Muslims on the importance of the spiritual element in the life of anybody, especially scientists, okay? Here is a quotation from one of their philosophers. This is how he looks at, a very important point here. All Muslims are not Arabs, and all Arabs are not Muslims. That's very important. So I'm shifting a little bit from Muslim to Arab, but let's keep that in mind. But Arabs, really, the essence of Islam started with the Arabs. Arabs have become the Hamlet of our times, doomed to unrelieved tragedy, forever hesitating, procrastinating, and wavering between the old and the new. All right? This is one of the key problems that today Arabs are facing because of governments that are really not democratic. Not one of those countries is really democratic other than Lebanon. You know, it's always self-propagating, always a almost a totalitarian state with the government perpetuating itself. They do things like in Iran, you know, supposedly it's a free election, but yet they control the results. This is true for all Arab countries, except for Lebanon. Okay, let's look, just a kind of a, this is a fun point, the Quran and science. Just like we do with our Bibles, you know, we do concordance. They do concordance too, that the Quran has said things that science either proves or disproves today. For example, creation is in 6 days. That's in the, one of their chapters. But a day is like 1,000 years, which is like we say, okay? So, which means that young earth is not an important thing. It's old earth is okay with them. They talk about seven heavens. We talk about three heavens. They start with the atom, the earth, the clouds, and so on. So they have seven heavens in the Bible. Mountains keep earth from shaking, all right? And then salt and fresh water are discussed in a way that as if it predicted osmotic pressure. So these two dudes, Bukhai and Moore and Torki, have taken whole lists of these things. In fact, it goes to such extremes that Big Bang was predicted in the Quran, the theory of relativity was predicted in the Quran. In a sense, there is a kind of a similarity the way some of us do try to do unnecessary concordance with Scripture. All right, same effort goes out there, which is an interesting commonality. We can at least talk about that we do the same thing, you guys. All right, in particular, let's look at Islam and Darwinian evolution. That's important because it's one of the main themes we have here. Young Earth creationism is absent in Muslim world because although 6 days is mentioned, a day, a thousand year thing makes it so almost all Muslims would say old Earth is fine. No problem there. So another point of commonality with us. Universe is billions years old, is commonly accepted. Opposition to Darwinian evolution is strong. And let me tell you, show you why. The reason is Darwinism presents a social and cultural threat leading to atheism. I was really pleased yesterday when Lauren presented that as a myth. Now, this is a real stumbling block. In fact, there is an article that came up in Science. It says, Bracing for Islamic Creationism, written by a Muslim scholar. It is a serious issue, primarily because they don't look at the mechanism issue here. They look at the fact that it's going to lead to atheism. And so that's another, as I go through, you can immediately pick certain points that we can really have discussions with. Adnan Oktar in Turkey is the loudest voice in this debate, and he supports intelligent design. He gets every publication on intelligent design is translated into Turkish and Arabic in Turkey and widely distributed among the Muslim countries. So the driving force is really intelligent design right now. Now, again, some claim that in the 11th century, one of the Muslim leaders, Ibn Ashwai, wrote about a common descent, but it didn't talk about natural selection. Again, there's always this debate. Who was the first in getting something going? The Muslims or the Christians or the Hindus? This is one item, and I think it's correct. He did talk about common descent. All right, really the important thing is the points to ponder. So let's just look at that with this background that I gave you. The first thing is, should we arrange an ASA Muslim panel at an annual meeting? In one of these meetings, have a special session in which we would invite Muslim scientists who take their religion seriously. In other words, they do pray five times a day. They do accept the tenets. But they also appreciate reason. Now, go back to the Golden Age. There, reason was given more emphasis than the Quran. The Quran was secondary, or even it was wrong. So, just like we do, you know, we don't say science is subordinate to the Bible, okay? We put them side by side and work with it. And there are many of my Muslim colleagues are in that category. And they have never really sat down and thought of harmonizing their faith with their with science. It would be an interesting example for them to see how we do things and see, you know, if there is... You know, the bottom line of this is this. The reason jihadist movement has gone so fast and has terrified us is that the moderate Muslims are not speaking out. That is one of the reasons I want to do this. It may be just a little drop in the ocean by having Muslim scientists and Christian scientists with their individual beliefs to come together, although the beliefs are widely different, all right? But at least it will encourage moderation and have them stand out and speak out just like this person has done in science. I put a question mark, and I want you to think about that, whether we should do something like this in one of our annual meetings. We are going to do, the Rocky Mountain, ASA Rocky Mountain, is planning a conference. There's a World Affairs Conference held in Boulder every year. It's a huge thing. Thousands attend. And next year it's going to be from April 4 to 8. They have never done anything on religion in this conference. We approached the organizers and said, what if we ASAers have a panel in which we'll invite a Christian who's a scientist but takes faith seriously? Why don't we have a Muslim doing the same thing? And why don't we have a rabbi or a scientist who's also a rabbi and take one or two topics, like how does your faith reflect on being a good steward in the world, right? That's one. Or science and faith, whichever one you prefer, and do it more, not as a debate, more like a kind of a dialogue, each presenting their, and they really loved it. They said, hey, let's do that. So I'm working on it now, trying to get key people from each one from ASA and one from, I'm already in contact with a scientist rabbi, and I'm trying to get a scientist who's also a Muslim. Someone in the Muslim will be someone in the spirit of Abdus Salam. Abdus Salam was very, very unusual. You know, he was the only Nobel laureate when he was getting his prize or whatever. He's the only Nobel laureate that openly gave thanks to God for giving him wisdom to discover this electroweak and electromagnetic. Only one. And there were several Christians who went through, and none of them spoke out. I really respect someone like that. And Abdus Salam was unusual in that sense. It's like another person like that was Rabi, I.I. Rabi. Look what he says. He was a Nobel laureate. Look how he talks. This is a conservative Jew. Physics filled me with awe, put me in touch with a sense of original causes. Physics brought me closer to God. That feeling stayed with me throughout my years in science. So these are the type of people you'd like to have come and discuss with us where they are and how they can do it. The other one is, we love all creation because of Creator. This is really a common ground. Muslims take this, Muslims intellectual scholars take this seriously. We love all creation because of a Creator. They do believe in a Creator separate from creation, and that we have responsibilities. That's another point of among many. This is one that really speaks out. Schurman wrote an article, I don't know how many of you remember, a year ago in PSCF, The Critique of Technology, Muslim's Critique of Technology. That is one of the things that he mentioned there. So far in ASA Journal, there has been one discussion or one presentation on Islam and Christianity, or Islam's position in science. Okay, of course, elbow out rigid orthodoxy and persuade moderates to bring intellectual rigor and personal freedom, cultural, social, and religious. One of the reasons there's rigid orthodoxy is because there really is very little freedom, personal freedom, in many of these Muslim countries. If you deviate too much from fundamental Islam, there is incarceration. Egypt is classic for this, and that's very unfortunate. And then, of course, Abdus Salam's insights and ASA missions are one and the same, really. If you see how he described his faith as a Muslim and his science, it's almost analogous to the way we have put our faith, our statement of faith, of being both true scientists and also having a faith and working on harmony between the two of them. And then the other one, I put it, theistic evolution is an option to avoid fear of atheism by Muslims. Theistic evolution is still very, very new among Muslims. And so this would be an interesting point of, hey, you know, you can believe in God and believe in evolutionary mechanism at the same time. So these are the points to ponder. And the question is, and I'll stop here for questions, is, as I said, does this make sense? Should we do something like this? Is really where I am right now. Okay, because so many Muslim scientists, friends who are close friends and they're Muslims, that I discuss all these things with them, and they're very open to dialogues of this type. So I just wanted to know if you think this makes sense for ASA.
Could you see having an equivalent organization to the ASA in Muslim countries?
They can. They don't. They don't have. They tend to keep their religion and science apart, most of them. But now they're starting to. They hear what we do, and they say, "Well, can we do it?" Yeah, it's a good. That's what I'm trying to foster from both ends. Yeah.
What happened at the end of the Golden Age?
What happened?
Yeah.
They translated Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, Hindu religion, the Bible. All of these were translated into Arabic from their originals, all right? So there was art, philosophy, literature. It was really, in fact, it was mini Renaissance, which died because of Al-Ghazali, who tried to stop the whole thing, and then came so-called Dark Ages, and then came the Renaissance, and the whole thing was recovered again. So the Muslims feel that, hey, we were the first one to start the Renaissance, in one sense, but it wasn't exactly Muslims. It was more of a joint effort.
So was it killed by his rise in Islamic fundamentalism?
Yeah. What happened is Al-Ghazali attacked the Greek philosophers, all right, and wanted to be pure Islam and science, and it didn't work, and then it kind of died. Yeah. And it's interesting, love. Al-Ghazali is one of the most read philosophers among the Arabs, which is unfortunate. Lynn, yeah.
Yes, thank you very much. And what kinds of discussions do you see as being most productive when this happens in Colorado at the conference? What do you hope will be some of the ways we discuss and the themes we discuss that will really make it promising so that people will want to say this was not a good idea?
Yeah, I think the best is have to do with the environment. You know, how does your faith or your holy books speak about being a good steward? This probably would be the most popular. The other, the secondary one would be how do you harmonize your faith with your science? Okay, I think the World Conference probably would, the World Affairs Conference would pick the first one rather than the second. And I'm giving this option to the people I'm writing to. Which one would you like to discuss and debate? Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Ideas,
yeah.
In terms of how does your faith impact your perspective on the environment, but then how does that play out tangibly in terms of the
information? Good point. Now, you say there's a book like that that was, I would like to.
Yeah, I require it on my students to read. I've just drawn a blank.
Yeah.
On the title.
I'll give you my card. I like to hear that. Good.
Mm-hmm. Many, Buddhism, Hinduism, lots of different world religions, but they pull from key thinkers within those religious groups to put together
One of the questions there, why not include Buddhism, Hinduism, and so on? It gets too complicated. I want to take the monotheistic religions because we have a little more common there to discuss. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Well, oh, sorry.
Just kind of a comment. Maybe you can comment on it. But I think it's kind of ironic that here in the South, where I live, anyway, there are a lot of these very conservative pastors who bash Islam as the evil empire or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But what they oftentimes want is a Christian version of this religion, culture, and politics, where Christianity takes over politics and culture, and it's because of culture wars. And I don't know, it's kind of ironic that what these conservative fundamentalist Christian pastors strive for is what Islam has, but they're bashing Islam at the same time.
Right.
And I wonder if you could kind of comment on that, or if there's anything...
Well, I just mentioned it's either fear, fury, or fascination. That's the way we look at Islam these days. We're afraid of them because of the jihadist movement. We get mad at them because their aim is destruction. And then you get fascinated, and you go to the other extreme, too. Boy, maybe these guys are correct after all. They have something, in other words. That's why they're growing so fast. But it's the same spirit. Yes, I agree with you. Yeah, one more.
Did you say that your central purpose for wanting to do this was to encourage moderate voices within Islam?
Yes, yeah. As one effort. Because moderates are remaining quiet. They're afraid, you know, but they're very strong. They're the majority, actually, especially in the Western countries. And so we need to put fire under it and see if we can do something. Yeah. That is my primary aim. Yeah. Okay, well, I guess we have to allow now for our next speaker. Well, thank you for, I appreciate it.